Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the National Press Club. I'm Gene Tai from the Speakers Committee, and want to welcome another one of our newsmaker events here at the Press Club. Welcome all of you to that. We are indeed honored today to have with us the Deputy Secretary of Defense, Ashton Carter. Dr. Carter was confirmed as Defense Secretary, Deputy Secretary of Defense in October of 2011 after serving as Undersecretary for Acquisition, Technology, and Logistics since April of 2009. Dr. Carter is a very lauded and longtime, well-known defense official to most of you, and I'd like, if possible, to have a few questions after he finishes with his remarks, and please direct those questions to the subject at hand, if you would, please. Let's give a big National Press Club welcome to Secretary Ashton Carter. Secretary.
Thank you, Gene, and thanks for the opportunity to be here once again at the Press Club. 1 month ago, it was now, Secretary Hagel gave a speech at the National Defense University that described the major strategic and budgetary challenges that and choices and also opportunities that we as a defense enterprise face. And I'd like to pick up where he left off and what will in one of what will undoubtedly be a series of discussions that extend over the spring and summer as we in the Defense Department with the Congress work together to try to put a stable and solid foundation under the strategic transition that we are embarked upon as a nation. As President Obama made clear in the new defense strategy we announced last January, we're turning a corner, a strategic corner. From a post-9/11 era dominated by two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, to the challenges and opportunities that will define our future in security. We know what many of those challenges are. Continued turmoil in the Middle East, the persistent threat of terrorism, enduring threats like weapons of mass destruction, and new threats like cyber. We also see great opportunities. Among them, the opportunity to shift the great weight of the Department of Defense, both physical and intellectual, that has been devoted to Iraq and Afghanistan to the Asia-Pacific region, where America will continue to play its seven-decade-old pivotal stabilizing role into the future. To develop innovative new capabilities from a vibrant defense technology base. To capitalize on the lessons of the last decade on how to use forces innovatively, including special forces and the integration of intelligence and operations, to manage presence in new ways, to leverage the reserve and guard components that have performed so superbly over the last decade, and to build the capacity of partners and allies so that they can shoulder more of the burden. This great strategic transition, which we need to make, coincides with the need to absorb some reductions in defense spending in the interest of the nation's overall fiscal situation. These two great historical currents are coming together. And it's my view that they can, if managed properly, reinforce one another. That's the task before us in the Department of Defense. In terms of our responsibility to the American taxpayer, we know that in making this strategic transition, we only deserve the amount of money we need and not the amount of money we're used to. That's why, well before the current budget turmoil, we made reductions to the department's budget by $487 billion over 10 years. This half-trillion-dollar adjustment came on top of significant adjustments that Secretary Gates made to eliminate unneeded or underperforming acquisition programs. Now, at the same time, our overseas contingency operations funding, which is not included in the base budget, and which is largely for Iraq and Afghanistan, otherwise known as wartime supplemental funding, is also decreasing now that we have exited Iraq and are drawing down our forces in Afghanistan. Taken together, these reductions compare in pace and magnitude to historical cycles in defense spending the nation has experienced in the past, after Vietnam and after the Cold War. In order to execute the President's defense strategy and to responsibly prepare for reductions in defense spending, we need to continue a relentless effort to make every defense dollar count. I began this effort in acquisition when I was the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition Technology and Logistics under the title Better Buying Power that continues under my successor, Frank Kendall. Extended throughout the entire department, this means making hard choices and persuading our own bureaucracy and ultimately the Congress to support even the very hardest of them. In acquisition, we made important changes to control costs, like setting targets for what systems should cost, a notion we are applying to the Joint Strike Fighter, the Ohio-class replacement missile submarine, and the new strategic bomber, to avoid outcomes like the VH-71 presidential helicopter, which ballooned to the point where it became unaffordable. We also gave renewed emphasis, where appropriate, to greater use of fixed-price contracts, an approach that we applied to the KCX, now the KC-46, aerial refueling tanker competition. We also learned from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan hard-earned lessons in speed and agility. We delivered the mine-resistant, ambush-protected all-terrain vehicle, MRAP ATV, which went from commander's need to production and fielding in less than 10 months, largely bypassing the ponderous acquisition system. Of course, the most important savings achieved through the MRAP program were in lives saved and the devastating injuries avoided, something that's truly priceless. Outside of acquisition, there are many other areas in which we simply must do better. Making better use of taxpayer dollars is important not only in its own right, since every dollar that's wasted could be used for the nation's defense, but is also important in order to win the taxpayers' confidence that they are getting full value for their defense dollar. This is a confidence we must earn to get the public and Congress to support a reasonable level of defense spending, such as the President's budget contains. And for this reason, I begin, as the department's entire leadership begins, with driving down tail to strengthen tooth. In this regard, we are placing a great emphasis on reducing the cost of what we in the Pentagon call the Fourth Estate, which consists of the Office of the Secretary of Defense, the Joint Staff, the staffs of the combatant commanders, and the defense agencies. The Fourth Estate represents a fifth of the department's budget, and it merits at least as much scrutiny as the military services budgets. There are real savings to be realized here. Next, we must drive down healthcare costs across the department. We have achieved substantial reductions in recent years, largely by holding down costs we spend to buy pharmaceuticals and pay healthcare providers, but also through modest increases in fees and copays assessed to beneficiaries. As a result of these and other efforts, our fiscal year 2014 budget request for the Defense Health Program at $49 billion is more than $3 billion lower than the fiscal year 2012 enacted level of $53 billion. In contrast, healthcare spending in the broader economy continues to grow faster than the overall rate of inflation. But we need to do more. And to that end, we must look at ways to make more efficient use of beds, staffing, and facilities at military treatment facilities, and again at healthcare fees. We also need to restructure our civilian workforce as we restructure our fighting forces. Specifically, we plan to reduce civilian workforce levels by between 5 and 6% over the next 5 fiscal years. These reductions are largely proportional to the military end strength reductions that we've proposed. Because they are contingent, in large part, upon our ability to consolidate our infrastructure and restructure our military treatment facilities, we will need a BRAC round to achieve them. Given this connection, we are submitting our request to Congress for a BRAC round in 2015. As Secretary Hagel recently testified before Congress, we believe BRAC is a comprehensive and fair tool that allows communities a role in reuse decisions for their property and provides redevelopment assistance. BRAC requires an upfront investment, and for that reason, the Future Year Defense Program adds $2.4 billion to pay for these costs. But in the long term, BRAC rounds have consistently generated significant savings. The previous 5 rounds of BRAC are saving $12 billion annually, and those savings will continue. Now, I realize BRAC is not exactly a crowd pleaser, and people often say to me, how can you propose that? And our answer really is, how can we not propose that? How can we not propose the cutting of tail and only the cutting of tooth? Finally, everyone who looks at the defense budget realizes that military compensation, like healthcare costs, cannot grow at unsustainable rates without threatening the force. We are therefore resubmitting a new package of military compensation proposals that we believe address congressional concerns raised last year. None of these new proposals would result in a reduction in pay or benefits. They simply reduce the rate of growth. Specifically, we are proposing a modest reduction in the growth of military pay by implementing a 1% pay raise for service members in fiscal year 2014 and a modest additional increase in TRICARE fees and pharmacy copays, as I alluded to above. Where applicable, these fee and copay increases would be phased in and have maximum limits to allow service members and retirees to adjust accordingly, and they would be grandfathered if appropriate. Excuse me one moment. Allergy season. Just as we are redoubling our efforts in fiscal year 2014 to obtain greater efficiencies in defense spending, we're also deepening our program alignment to the President's strategy. Let me remind you what the key tenets of that strategy are. The first is that as we draw down from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, our force needs to make a very difficult transition from a large, rotational, counterinsurgency-based force to a leaner, more agile, more flexible, and ready force for the future. That's not to say there's anything wrong with the force that we built for Iraq and Afghanistan. It was the right force for the period. But this is a different period. As we make this transition, we want to preserve what we've worked so hard to achieve in the last decade. First, the tremendous strength that the all-volunteer force has brought to this fight over the last 10 years and the qualities that they embody. Second, the use of special operations forces and their integral application in modern operations. Third, the contribution of the Guard and Reserve. We used the Guard and Reserve in this era in a way never foreseen, and they performed superbly. I've been to Iraq and Afghanistan many times. I'll be leaving again day after tomorrow. And you can never tell the difference between an active duty and reserve component unit in terms of their proficiency and dedication. Fourth, the fusion of intelligence and operations, an area where we have unrivaled capability. And fifth, new and disruptive technologies, all conceived and fielded over the past decade. This is the legacy of Iraq and Afghanistan that we want to preserve and adapt as we turn the strategic corner. Second key tenet of the new strategy has to do with protecting and prioritizing key investments in technology and in new capabilities. President Obama insisted that we go out of our way to protect our newest investments because these kinds of investments tend to have the shallowest roots and are therefore most susceptible to being bureaucratically uprooted. Because these investments are so important to keeping the technological edge, which so much of our national security depends on, the President wanted to ensure that we didn't eat our seed corn in the process of reducing our budget. In this regard, we are continuing, even in our current budgetary environment, to grow our Special Operations Forces. A portion of this somewhat larger force will be redeployed from Iraq and Afghanistan to locations around the world. The remainder, not unimportantly, will have a chance to reset and be home with family more than they've been able to do over the past decade. Next, we're increasing our investments in cyber in recognition of the growing threat that cyber poses to our national security and critical infrastructure. I said increasing our investments in cyber. Our fiscal year 2014 budget request repurposes and adds manpower to create cyber teams in our three primary functional areas, namely defending Department of Defense networks, degrading adversary cyber capabilities, and supporting the defense of the nation's critical infrastructure. Space, like cyber, is also an area where we have a large installed base upon which we depend, and we need to figure out how we either defend it where that's possible or where it's not possible because of the nature of orbital dynamics and the inherent vulnerability of an object in space, how to operate without it if we need to. We're also developing options to counter the space capabilities of potential adversaries. Another area where the president wanted protected is countering weapons of mass destruction. We still have a non-LUGAR program, and it's very active and operational. We're also investing in intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance platforms. You see the Predators and Reapers at work. You see the Global Hawk, which is the higher altitude platform. Then there are other things you don't see. We have an innovative effort to increase the range of our unmanned vehicles and to operate unmanned vehicles from ships and other areas of innovation in ISR that don't involve unmanned aircraft, but other techniques. Finally, we're increasing our investments in certain areas of our science and technology portfolio, such as electronic warfare, anti-jamming capabilities, and command, control, and communications. It's always been the case that the Department of Defense led innovation and contributed to innovation at the national level. Today, there's a larger commercial technology base relative to DoD's than there used to be, and of course, the overall technology base is global. But still in all, there's a leadership role for the Department of Defense. And despite our fiscal challenges, this is an area that will remain a priority. The third key tenet of our new defense strategy concerns our rebalance to the Asia-Pacific region. Our rebalance, to be clear, is predominantly a political and economic concept, not a military one. But since I'm the Deputy Secretary of Defense, I naturally focus on its security aspects. And in the security sphere, the logic of our rebalance is very simple. The Asia-Pacific has largely enjoyed overall peace and stability for 60 years, part, of course, from the Vietnam War. And the only exception to that today, and a dangerous one, is North Korea. We're responding to North Korea's threats. We're doing it by defending ourselves and our allies. We're taking a firm but measured approach. But North Korea is an exception, really the only exception, in terms of imminent nation-state aggression in the Asia-Pacific region. This climate of peace and stability has prevailed in the Asia-Pacific region for so long, despite the fact that there's been no overarching security structure, no NATO, to make sure that historical wounds, which were deep in Asia, were healed after World War II. And during those years, First, Japan rose and prospered, then South Korea rose and prospered, then many nations in Southeast Asia rose and prospered, and today, India and China rise and prosper. And all this has been welcomed by the United States. But none of this was a foregone conclusion when you consider where Asia was at the end of World War II. While the Asian political and economic miracle was realized first and foremost by the hard work and talent of the Asian people themselves, it was enabled by the enduring principles that the United States has stood for in the region, and also by American military power. The principles we've stood for have included a commitment to free and open commerce, a just international order that emphasizes rights and responsibilities and responsibilities of nations, fidelity to the rule of law, civilian control of the military, open access by all to the shared domains of sea, air, space, and now cyberspace, and the principle of resolving conflict without the use of force. In addition to these principles, it was also enabled by the pivotal role of U.S. military power and presence in the region. We believe that our strong security presence in the Asia Pacific has provided a critical foundation for these principles to take root. And in one sentence, our rebalance says we're going to continue to provide this foundation for decades to come. Our partners in the region welcome our leadership and our robust engagement and the values that underlie them. And therefore, I believe that our rebalance will be welcomed and will be reciprocated. It's good for us, it's good for everyone in the region, and it includes everyone in the region. And by the way, it's not aimed at anyone in the region, no individual country or group of country. Our rebalance is reflected in force structure decisions, presence and posture, investments, innovations in our operational plans and tactics, and perhaps most importantly, in the work we're doing to strengthen our alliances and partnerships in the region. I've given a number of recent speeches here in town and in Asia that describe each of these lines of effort in significant detail, and in the interest of time, I just refer you to them. Needless to say, there's a lot going into this undertaking. And when I'm asked to discuss it, asked about the rebalance, I'm usually asked two questions. The first is, can you do it? Can you do it with the budgetary challenges that you face? And the answer to this question is yes, we can do the rebalance, and here's why. First, as I mentioned earlier, we're shifting that huge weight that we have applied to Iraq and Afghanistan to the Asia-Pacific region. And a second reason is that within our budget, which is still substantial, we are making investments in this region a priority. Next, in addition to the current weight of our defense spending, you also have to take into account that it has accumulated over time. It takes decades to build a military capability like ours. And it's also true that in addition to having substantial resources, our force has substantial operational experience, which no other military can match. So for all these reasons, we can do it. And the second question I get is, isn't our rebalance really about China? And the answer is no, our rebalance is not about China. The rebalance is not aimed at anyone, any individual country or group of countries. It's about ensuring the peace and stability that the Asia Pacific has enjoyed for 60 years continues. Now, in a normal budgetary environment, an efficiencies and strategy-driven approach to defense, such as I've described, and which is reflected in the president's budget, would be sufficient. But this budgetary environment is anything but normal, particularly because we're operating under the sequester. Sequester is not only regrettable in its own right, but it distracts from the true strategic and managerial tasks that are upon us. Sequester requires us to subtract from our budget for the remainder of fiscal year 2013, $37 billion. And it presumes that we take equal shares or proportionate shares from each and every part of the budget, which is the worst managerial approach possible. Secretary Hagel and I, and the entire leadership of the department are doing everything we possibly can under this deliberately restrictive law to mitigate its harmful effects on national security. Everything we possibly can. For example, the President used his authority under the law to exempt military compensation from sequestration. We also must, of necessity, fully protect funding for our forces in Afghanistan and other ongoing operations, and we're doing that. It turns out that our Afghanistan war costs have been higher this year than we anticipated, in part because of a higher than expected operating tempo, and in part because of increased transportation costs due to the extended closure of the Pakistan ground lines of communication. Next, we're fully protecting Wounded Warrior programs. We're fully protecting our core nuclear deterrent. Critical portions of homeland defense, like the ability to interdict hijacked airliners. Some special operations forces and other critical capabilities. And we're fully protecting key other expenditures, such as those, for example, that will allow school children in our military schools to finish the school year such that their attendance can be fully accredited. Next, there are things that we're preferentially protecting to the extent possible. First, key features of the new defense strategy, such as the ones I've described. Second, forces forward deployed to the Asia-Pacific and Persian Gulf for possible near-term contingencies. For example, the ability to, as we say, fight tonight if there's aggression on the Korean Peninsula. Third, military family programs. And fourth, certain acquisition efficiencies like multi-year contracts. But we cannot exempt or protect most of our budget. And so you see serious repercussions of sequester appearing as the months go by. Now you might ask, why does this turbulence hit so hard so fast? Why does an 8% sequester budget cut lead to a crisis in readiness, as the Joint Chiefs of Staff have so aptly called it? To understand this requires some explanation. Sequestration commenced on March 1st, and as I noted, will reduce DoD funding for FY13 by $37 billion. Now, about $20 billion of that $37 billion cuts affects our operations or O&M, operations and maintenance, or O&M accounts, the accounts that most influence day-to-day military readiness. But it gets worse for O&M. The wartime or OCO budget is also subject to sequestration, and most of this must come from the same O&M accounts. To protect funding for our troops at war, which is a must, we have to impose extra cuts on the base budget portion of O&M. Worse yet, 2 years ago, when we were estimating the costs of wartime operations, we could not foresee the higher than expected operating tempo and transportation of costs that we're experiencing this year. So now we have to make further cuts in base budget O&M in order to sustain wartime operations. So the bottom line is cuts in the base budget portion of O&M will be more than 20% compared to our request. And we have only about 6 months left to accommodate most of these cuts. So much for the 8% sequester cut. We realized last January, before sequester kicked in, that we had potentially large budget problems, and we began taking action then. We imposed hiring freezes, cuts in travel and conferences, reductions in facilities maintenance, and much more. Now that sequester is in effect, we are preparing a request to Congress to move money from other accounts into O&M, called reprogramming. We will be urging Congress to approve that reprogramming quickly. But unfortunately, this won't be enough. Reprogramming will help with much of the wartime O&M funding problem, but by law, reprogramming is limited, and it's not large enough to address the sequester. We will still have to make large cuts in training and maintenance, which in turn are seriously harming readiness. In short, the reprogramming addresses the war costs, but not sequester. And to understand it's the effects of all this, let me start with the Army. Among numerous training-related actions, the Army plans to cancel at least 6 remaining combat center training sessions for its brigade combat teams. These are the culminating training events, and their cancellation seriously harms readiness. By the end of the fiscal year, excluding deployed units, two-thirds of Army active brigade combat teams, two-thirds, and most of the reserves will be below acceptable readiness levels. This means that we are less ready for contingency operations, and it may interfere with our ability to replace units in Afghanistan next year. The Air Force has or will soon stop all flying for 12 combat-coded squadrons, which means that about one-third of its active squadrons will be markedly less ready to meet contingency demands. The Air Force is also reducing or stopping training at numerous other squadrons. This is not only dangerous, it will also be expensive to repair the damage. Once you lose flying proficiency, it is very expensive and time-consuming to get it back. The Navy and Marine Corps are also cutting back on flight operations and fleet operations. The Navy has imposed flying restrictions on some non-deployed carrier air wings, and as you've seen, we're not sending ships to sea as we had planned. As the Navy cuts back on maintenance, support, and steaming days, there will be fewer opportunities for the Marines to train, which will in turn degrade their readiness. Finally, we may have to consider furloughing many of our civilian employees in order to hold down operating costs. Secretary Hagel has not made a final decision on furloughs, but if we have to impose them, they will harm morale and productivity throughout most of our support functions, and this will in turn further damage readiness. What's tragic in all this damage to readiness and national security, is that it's not a result of economic emergency or a recession in this country. It's not because defense cuts are the answer to the nation's overall fiscal challenge. Do the math. It's not in reaction to a sudden transformation to a more peaceful world. It's not due to a breakthrough in military technology or to a new strategic insight of some sort. It's not because paths of revenue growth and entitlement spending have been explored and exhausted. It's purely the collateral damage of political gridlock. We have and will still have the most formidable military in the world, but we are accepting unnecessary risk. Now, the sequester for FY 2013 ends on October 1st. But there's no way to know for sure what's next here in Washington. The DOD can adjust and adapt to a wide range of contingencies. But this will be easiest if we have stability, time, and flexibility. The President has submitted a budget that meets these goals. The President's budget reflects his overall approach to deficit reduction. For defense, it contains $150 billion more in 10-year cuts compared to last year's plan, on top of the $487 billion reflected in the Department of Defense's fiscal year 2013 budget. Most of these cuts occur beyond 2018, which gives us time to plan and adjust. While no agency wants to cut its budget, the President's plan is much more practical than the cuts that would occur under the Budget Control Act. Cuts that could amount to $52 billion in FY 2014 alone and a total of $500 billion over the next 10 years. We urgently need Congress to grant us stability, time, and flexibility. The House budget resolution, the Senate budget resolution, and of course the Budget Control Act all confront us not with stability, but with an exceedingly wide range of future scenarios for our budget. We also need Congress's support to have the flexibility to make budget cuts where they are most in the interests of long-term national defense. Last year, Congress denied proposals we had made, ranging from healthcare efficiencies to force structure and modernization proposals that our leadership had proposed and comprehensively justified. Most immediately, additionally, we need reprogramming relief from Congress for fiscal year 2013 in order to shift money to meet our highest priorities. Ideally, we will have all three elements, stability, time, and flexibility, with which to make critical budget decisions. But we must anticipate a wide range of possible contingencies. In this regard, for this reason, Secretary Hagel asked me, working with Chairman Dempsey, to conduct a strategic choices and management review to examine the choices that underlie our defense strategy, posture, and investments, including all past assumptions and systems. The review will define the major strategic choices and institutional challenges affecting the defense posture in the decade ahead that must be made to preserve and adapt our defense strategy and the department's management under a wide range of future circumstances that could result from a comprehensive deficit reduction deal or the persistence of the cuts that began with this year's sequester. Everything will be on the table during this review: roles and missions, war planning, business practices, force structure, personnel and compensation, acquisition and modernization investments, and how we operate, how we measure and maintain readiness. We plan to complete our work and provide decision points and recommendations to Secretary Hagel in the coming weeks and months. The choices the Secretary and the President make in response to decision points identified in the review in the months thereafter will then inform our fiscal year 2015 budget submission, as well as how we execute our fiscal year 2014 budget. So in closing, we in the Defense Department are prepared to make difficult strategic and budgetary choices. We're also committed to finding new ways to improve the way we do business and obtain greater efficiency and productivity in defense spending. But in order to sustain our military's unrivaled strength, we need the cloud of sequester dispelled, not just moved to the horizon. And we need a return to normal budgeting. Together with the Congress, we can then continue the great strategic transition upon which we have embarked with certainty and stability. Thank you. Now I'd be pleased to take some questions.
If you would please stand up, identify yourself, and please stick to the subject at hand, too, if you would.
Thank you, Sebastian Sprager with Inside the Pentagon. A quick follow-up. You mentioned outer space activities. Uh-huh. Just a clarification on what's going on in that space. And then, looking forward, what changes do you see in the employment of the Guard and Reserve, both in terms of provision and labor with the actual force and cost?
Both excellent questions. First of all, with respect to space, we have established, really for the first time, an integrated effort to bring together our space programs, all of them, with those folks who understand best the anti-satellite threat, and also how we can operate, if we have to, without spacecraft. So we have an integrated effort now that looks constellation by constellation. If there is a threat, and there are threats, to those space systems, How can we make them more resilient so that that threat can be withstood? Or alternatively, how we can, as we call it, operate through if we don't have that capability. That is a new effort, and one that we are devoting resources to newly, and this is budget, something that in my judgment long overdue. And at the same time, we're looking at making investments in our own capability to deny the use of space against our forces in a conflict. So both sides of that equation we're looking at. Respect to Guard and Reserve, Guard and Reserve, the reserve component over the course of the last decade has made a really remarkable contribution that nobody foresaw, that we would be engaged in long, large counterinsurgency operations that required a very large rotation force of the kind that we've operated for the last 10 years. We needed the Guard and Reserve, and they came through. And there's a lesson in there about the adaptability and the relevance of the Guard and Reserve component. And so now as we turn this strategic corner to the future, we're looking for innovative ways to use the Guard and Reserve components in the new era. So there are missions, for example, like, I'll just take one example, operation of remotely piloted aircraft that might be, and in fact are, suited to guard units. There is the Homeland Defense mission. I'm in have had a number of meetings with the Council of Governors to help them articulate the needs for defense support to civil authorities, some of which, probably much of which, will be provided through the Guard and Reserve. So in all these ways, the Guard and Reserve are going to be very relevant in the future. It's just going to be different from the era of Iraq and Afghanistan. So that's an exciting sort of frontier for us and for the Guard and Reserve.
Hi. Sorry. John Donnelly with Congressional Quarterly. We have a roll call. Question about the strategic choices and management. Can you tell us a little bit more about what's going to be involved there? You're going to be looking at alternative budget scenarios. Have you decided which ones, for example, President's budget, A, B, $52 billion less, C, something else? The Senate Armed Services Committee has asked you to describe what a $52 billion cut would look like. And are you just going to lay out illustrative scenarios, or is this actually going to be a set of proposals for things to reduce under these alternative scenarios?
Well, I mean, you're A and B, yes. Obviously, the president's yes, and others as well. Others sort of in between, if you like. The we have to foresee, and that's where Senators Levin and Inhofe, that's what they were indicating in their letter, that much as none of us might like that, we have to take seriously the possibility that we stay, that what happened this year could happen again and again and again. And it's in our DNA to be ready, even for things that we don't that is why, and to get ahead of that is why Secretary Hagel ordered the review, so that we're ready for a whole range of contingencies of that, certainly the two that you've named. And in terms of the output, I mean, what we're not going to be doing is making a proposal to be sequestered, but by proposal, what is the product, and the product is a clear delineation of the choices that we can make and might have to make in each of the areas I've described, whether they be an element of force structure or an element of investment. Or in compensation, or in healthcare, or in headquarters support, all of these areas where we spend money. How can we do things differently? How might we have to do things differently in order to give the country the defense it needs for the amount of money we're going to get in each of those scenarios? That's the purpose of the review, and that's what it'll do. Oh, for sure. A lot of them are things. A lot of things we can do ourselves. I mean, at the end of the day, of course, the Congress is the approves and passes our budget. In that sense, they have to approve everything that we do. But a lot of this is stuff that we can seize the initiative internally and will and need to. Sure. It has in each and every one of the areas I've described and made substantial progress in terms of framing these choices. I would say we have reviewed between a third and a half of them so far, this far along. And in some cases, they're in reasonably good shape, and in other cases, people need to be pushed harder. To work harder, think more innovatively, and be bolder, because at the more extreme range of those contingencies we might face, we have to be bold. Yeah.
Autumn Carson, Sea Power Magazine. One of the heartburns of service, particularly the Army and Marine Corps, having looking ahead to FY 14, is the lack of an OCO fund. You guys both are working on that.
Sure. This is the OCO request for FY 14, and the answer is in the next few weeks we will make our FY 14 OCO proposal. A lot of the work is done on that. Now, of course, when you're doing an OCO proposal, you are forecasting the amount of money that you will need in a conflict 2 years from now. And that's the reason why it's difficult to prepare an OCO budget. And of course, the FY14 is a transitional year in Afghanistan. And so what we'll be doing there will depend upon decisions that the United States and the rest of the coalition make in the months ahead, and not all of those decisions have been made. So we're making our best estimates, based upon what we know, but of course we can't know everything about an ongoing war. I think we'll know a lot of the president's decisions. That still doesn't mean that you know everything that's going to happen 2 years from now in a war. So there's an inevitable amount of estimation that goes into the preparation of an OCO budget. That's what OCO is all about. OCO is all about the unpredictable expenditures associated with an ongoing conflict. So it's not a science, but we get pretty good at it after these years. Yeah. Well, we would. We're not asking for that now. We know that our reprogramming authority is capped. So the reprogramming that we're going to submit will confine itself within the statutory bounds. What I was telling you was that as a consequence, will, if approved by the Congress, will address our OCO shortfall problem. It will not address sequestration. So I just want to emphasize that point. Our reprogramming doesn't take care of sequestration, doesn't address sequestration. It takes care of our other big problem, which is the OCO shortfall. We certainly hope that'll be approved, but there are statutory limits to the reprogramming that can be granted. We would like to see those limits changed, by the way, of course. Yeah. Well, that's one of the areas that we can most clearly identify and protect readiness for. What you see happening elsewhere in readiness, as I described, is our capability to respond to the unforeseen. And there will be an impact there. That's why was saying that this is not only stupid, it's not safe to be under this sequester thing.
Could you be more specific, though? You're saying it is predictable, so at what point does it really start to get to be a serious concern for areas like North Korea where you need to be ready?
We're working as hard as we can to make sure that our commitments to things like the defense of the peninsula is protected to the maximum degree possible. We're doing that and we will keep doing that, but it comes under increasing stress as time goes on. We'll have to see what happens as the years go on. Yep.
Sir, Mark Shantz, Air Force Magazine. I want to go back to the comment you made about the Pentagon's fourth estate.
Mm-hmm. No, yes, it's a good question. The fourth estate is a informal term that is meant to signify the fourth part of our enterprise other than the Department of the Army, the Department of the Navy, and the Department of the Air Force. These are important functions. They're not headquarters functions. That's a small part of it. They are things like the Defense Logistics Agency that handles all our logistics, including in the theater in Afghanistan. So these aren't headquarters. These aren't people like me sitting in offices in Washington. That is included in the Fourth Estate. Those headquarters functions and so forth. I mean, I believe that we need to shrink those headquarters functions also, at least as much as everything else is shrinking. So for sure, we must do that. We're going to do that. But that isn't where most of the money is. Most of it is in the so-called field agencies, combat support agencies. They're doing important work. But they're part of our enterprise, and they need to fall under the same level of scrutiny that we have to apply to the Navy, the Army, and the Air Force in these times. And all I'm saying is we're going to make sure that we don't just pay attention to the Army, Navy, and Air Force, but we pay attention to every nickel we spend wherever it is.
We've got time for about another question.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Gopal Ruckman with Bloomberg News. Paul. You talked about Secretary Hagel not having taken a decision or made a decision on the furloughs, but the Navy has told Congress that they may not need any furloughs and they can actually manage with the savings internally. Two questions. So one, is the danger of furloughs somewhat overblown? And number two, the longer you take to make a decision on furloughs, is there a danger that you may need to furlough people for longer periods of time as the end of the year approaches in order to achieve the savings?
First of all, none of us wants to do furloughs. Not a way of signifying to people who are working for us and for national defense, working as hard as our uniform people are, that their contributions are appreciated. So, nobody wants to furlough. What you're up against and what we're up against and the Secretary of Defense is up against is balancing where we take cuts as the year goes on in the interests of the overall accomplishment of the defense mission. And so one of the possibilities there is to furlough, meaning essentially put on part time for the last now quarter of the year, some or most of our civilian employees. That would be a way of trying to free up funding that would then go to critical readiness functions. And it's assessing those critical readiness functions and where we have to put money in the final months of the year that compels this, along with many, many other difficult decisions that we just have to make. But in no way does it suggest that these folks are anything but essential to the enterprise. Otherwise, they wouldn't be our employees in the first place. You're my host. You take one more if you want to take one more, and then I got to go. Chris, again.
One more on the budget. Do you think it's more likely than not that you'll see a CR this year again, and also that you'll see another round of sequestration?
I've stopped calling the odds, Chris, but I can't rule it out, and therefore we have to be serious about that contingency. That's the reason for the review. So sadly, I can't rule that out. And so we have to be ready. That's an unfortunate thing if it happens. And obviously we want our FY14 budget enacted in a timely way. But looking at recent history, I can't be sure that's going to happen. So we have to be ready in case that doesn't happen. And we will.
Mr. Secretary, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Good to be with you, Gene. Thank you.